8 a.m. having arrived. I'm going to call the Committee on Taxes to order. We do not have a quorum yet, but members, we will get started. So we've got Representative Hewitt here that will present on House File 1993. And so, Representative Hewitt, we're not going to move your bill at this time because we don't have a quorum, but we're going to take testimony and so forth. So, Representative Hewitt, welcome to the committee. If you would like to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm happy to be back in front of the Tax Committee again, and today I bring a real important issue to you from across the state. I've been involved in EMS and fire for over 30 years, and this has always been a problem for us, recruitment and retention. And this is one tool that we're kind of looking at experimenting with. As you know, the legislators have tried to do things in the past, from work groups to committees to incentivize. Well, this is one area that we haven't dove into yet. So we were with the individuals in the fire associations and the ambulance association, and we got together and said, well, let's try to see what a tax credit would do. It does have a hefty fiscal note, but what you have to remember is these are the volunteers that leave in the middle of the night, work 3 hours on a fire, and then go to work the next morning. Or the EMTs that do the similar job where they end up having to answer the call at Christmas morning and take a transport down to the cities, and they miss their whole Christmas day with their family. So these people give up a lot for this, and when you look at the fiscal note, yeah, it's high, but they give up a lot for us too. So today I have two testifiers with me. I'm first going to have you hear from Chief Dill of Invergrove Heights to express some of her concerns with recruitment and retention.
Good morning.
Very good. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'd please state your name and please speak.
Judy Thill.
Dill?
Thill, T-H-I-L-L.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you for having me this morning. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota State Fire Department Association and Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. Personally, I'd like to thank Representative Hewitt for his work on this tax credit. Recruitment and retention has been a huge problem for many, many years, not just here in Minnesota, but nationwide. In fact, many of you may not know, 92% of our firefighters in Minnesota are volunteers. We have the second highest percentage of volunteers in the nation. Recruitment and retention, as I said, has been in a critical stage, and it's only getting worse as training increases and calls increase. While it used to be 20 years or more that volunteer firefighters would stay on a fire department, now the average is about 5 years, and the first 1 year or 2 years is solely on training. So we're trying to not only attract firefighters, we're also trying to retain them. So we'd like to offer support today for this tax credit for volunteer firefighters and EMT, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And before we go any further, we do now have a quorum, so we're going to do a few things and end this, and then get this bill in proper order. So, members, we do have the minutes from Thursday, March 14th, 2019. Representative Les Legarde moves to approve those minutes. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion on approval of the March 14th minutes, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The March 14th minutes are approved. Also, members, in your packets, you'll see that as of Friday, March 15th, there were 8 bills that were referred to the Property and Local Tax Commission. With that, Representative Brand moves House File 1993 for possible inclusion into the omnibus tax bill. All right, got everything set. So, Representative Hewitt, looks like you have another witness.
I do, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to introduce to you, well, this man needs no introduction in front of you, Mr. McAlpin from the Ambulance Association.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, members, Buck McAlpin representing the Minnesota Ambulance Association. The Ambulance Association's worked quite a long time. We've had called a rural EMS sustainability work group and worked closely with our friends in the fire service. most importantly because the fire service is our first responder network, and many of the fire service has ambulance operations across the state. In 1993, the Department of Health released a report called The Quiet Crisis in Minnesota, very thick document about the decline of access to emergency medical services throughout the state. As Ms. Dell testified to, about 62% of our 300 ambulance services in Minnesota and 28,000 EMTs and paramedics are still volunteer. And again today, and I've said in other committees this year, there's parts across the state that we're not sure if the ambulance and or your rural first responder would show up if you called 911, and we're trying to work on ways to make sure that doesn't happen. I think the industries have gotten a lot better about discussing consolidation, how they work better with their neighbors. You've seen bills in front of this committee, Mr. Chair and members, around taxing districts, what's happening up in Cloquet. The fire chiefs have been down here about the fire-based taxing district, just different ideas of how we consolidate and look at operations differently. But still, there's just this large aspect of volunteers out there and what they do every year. And then 2 years ago, the Department of Health with the Ambulance Association completed another large statewide survey funded with the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care that said since 93 it's only gotten worse around the volunteer area. So we do see large companies like Allina or North Memorial or Health East or Mayo Medical Transportation really starting to absorb a lot of the statewide EMS systems and trying to cover larger areas, but they're just as such a large geographic population. I'm looking at Representative Fabian, especially up in northwest and southwest and northeast Minnesota, that really rely on volunteer ambulance operations to do their work. And Representative Hewitt's comments, the mental health crisis, we have ambulance services going from Cloquet to Fargo daily, just trying to find beds for people. And lots of that work's being done by volunteer ambulance people leaving their jobs every day. So when he brought this idea up again, and I believe Representative Davis has also had this idea in the past that we've tossed this same tax credit around, this is one of the issues that comes up during our surveys. Access to health care comes up for our volunteers in rural Minnesota. We did some work with the Minnesota Care Tax a few years ago. But the Ambulance Association's Rural Sustainability Group meets monthly, a very large group across the state, of how we try to address the issue to be sure the ambulance or first responder squad leaves the garage. So we appreciate your support, looking for what we just call another tool in the toolbox to try to make sure we can keep the ambulance leaving the garage.
Thank you. Chair David.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe for Mr. McAlpin. I think it was in the Chair Lincheski, Chair Scoy's Tax Bill of 14. I was on the conference committee, if I remember correctly, where we did something like this in a test area. Maybe I think like 13 counties, and then there's something about Freeborn County came in or whatever. Yeah, is that similar to what we're doing here? Is this a different way to do it? Because we put it out there as a test, and has there been any information coming back saying did it help in those areas?
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, yes, that was in, I believe, 13 counties, and it was a tax credit to those areas, and I believe it's sunsetted now, but that did work very well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I had some questions, Mr. McAlpin. So what were the results there? Are there some quantifiable results? Did it help retain volunteers? Did it help attract volunteers? Because it is sunset now. So what were the results?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's a good idea. We should dig that up for further discussions. But folks just said it was when we talked to the fire chiefs, it was a great tool, and for our ambulance volunteers to use it to try to keep some folks in retention over what they did. And because it was a pilot, it was also very hard to launch it, too, as we worked through public safety and the fire marshal's office about how we did that. But I believe at that time, Mr. Chair, a large fiscal note also came in, which we negotiated it down to a pilot project to make it work.
Very good. I do know that is a huge concern around the state. In my areas, I've had meetings trying to attract folks, and, you know, they're volunteers, so certainly they're not in it for the money. So what do you see any of the testifiers here is probably the biggest reasons why we're seeing a decline? Is it just... Ms. Dell?
There are actually several reasons. First, we have both people in the household working. It used to be that the wife would stay home and take care of the children, and the husband would be able to work and join the fire department. Now, with both parties working and also females joining the fire service, it becomes a little more complicated there. There's also an increase in training requirements. I have volunteers on my department, and they go through the exact same training as a full-time firefighter. Why? Because it's a very dangerous job. Yeah. And so I wouldn't be able to sleep at night if I didn't require that kind of training, because I don't want to see them get hurt or killed, obviously. So they go through the same amount of training. It is a lot of training. Right from the start, you're looking at 100, 150 hours just for basic firefighting. And then there's all kinds of EMS 40. If they're EMP, what is it, 120, 140 hours on top of that. And this is in their spare time. They do this work in their spare time, and that's what really makes it hard for people. And on top of everything else, there has been mission creep with fire departments, because they are starting to do a lot more EMS response, basic first response, and they're being called out more often, where they might have only gone to 150 calls or 200 calls. Now they're going to 400 or 500 calls, and that is a huge imposition on their family life and their spare time.
Very good. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to thank Representative Hewitt and thank you for bringing this forward. I think obviously the recruitment and retention piece is important, but I think even if we aren't able to prove one way or another whether it helps with that, I think, you know, when I think of what we ask of firefighters and EMTs, it's exposure to lifelong trauma and cancer risks. It's a really dangerous job, and it really, I can see how a family member might not want somebody to volunteer to do that just because of the risks that they're putting themselves out there for. So I think, you know, it's a non-refundable credit, and I think a recognition of the folks who are willing to put their lives on the line to make sure the rest of us can be safe. I think that that's a worthy endeavor, regardless of whether there's a direct impact on recruitment, because that tells me the people that are still doing it are the people whose hearts are really in it and are really committed to making sure they're taking care of their communities. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I had a question about the experiment. Was that also 500 per person and 1,000 per couple if they both happen to be?
Mr. McKelvin.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I don't remember the exact details of the amount.
Okay, I was
Representative Carlson.
I was just interested in kind of comparing what was before us in the bill with that experiment that took place. Just a comment, and I'm kind of picking up on the chief's point about more difficult to get volunteers. I was at a meeting a while back on the education side, and they were talking about the difficulty today, you know, getting volunteers. They used to be able to get a number of parents, I think generally sometimes it might be grandparents or others that would be willing to come into the schools to volunteer in a variety of ways, both during the school day or after school activities. And their point was that it's getting more and more difficult. And I think we're seeing that then here with your testimony that volunteerism is down. But my only point is that apparently it's down generally from what I hear. Thank you.
Representative Twozinski.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a thought, you know, the testifier spoke a little bit to just heart why we're having such an issue. And one of the issues that I've heard is also just from an employer standpoint that, you know, if you're self-employed or have your own business, it's a little easier for you to just pick up and go. If you work for somebody else and they're depending on you being there, you know, getting that permission to kind of make that step. And I maybe just had a general question to staff potentially, you know, is there any tax credits out there for employers who to try to encourage them to allow you know, their employees to participate in these? Because sometimes that can be a pretty decent barrier where, you know, they could maybe, you know, I've heard of some employers actually, like, especially like electricians or within the trades, that they'll pay their employee, you know, they're clocked in for the day. If they get called, they don't have to clock out. They continue to pay them throughout the day. So some of these employers are really making a big effort and kind of helping things out. But just was, you know, thinking, you know, maybe there's something that we could do to kind of encourage from an employer standpoint to encourage that, because if they're an employee, you know, that would
just sure, an idea. Mr. Chair.
I know I put you on the spot there, folks, but.
Well, let's start with Mr. Williamson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zinski, I don't think there's any existing tax credit or program that sort of matches the description you just gave.
Representative Hewitt?
And Mr. Chair, to answer the representative's question, we did look at this actually in this bill because we thought maybe that was an answer. We looked at different things that actually in some of our towns, actually a few of the schools, and I forgot which ones they were, but let the seniors actually respond to medicals during the day. We don't want to set that in place, but they're going down and using 18-year-old students to do some of the work, too. I know a couple of our colleges in towns, in Morris, actually, they use their students to come and respond. They call them out of class. As far as businesses go, there are I looked around this country to look at this option, too, and there are different states that actually do give business credits to do that. I don't know how successful that has been. The thing I like about this particular thing is a lot of times when we do that, it doesn't get down to the individual, and that's what this basically would do is get to the individual.
So also, Mr. Jessen was doing some research here, and the bill that Chair Davids was referring to passed in 2014. It was in effect for 15, 16, and 17, and that was a $500 stipend for firefighters and EMTs and volunteer ambulance. So it's very close to what this is, which is $500 per person or $1,000 credit per if both spouses would be involved. So Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. McAlpin mentioned Northwest Minnesota. Not that it's important, but I spent my 5 years doing the EMT thing up there too many, many years ago. I have a question on the bill, but also just one comment. We have this incredible manufacturer in my hometown that makes Polaris. I can't say their name, can I? Darn. Make ATVs and snowmobiles. And when the fire whistle blows, there are several pickup trucks that leave the parking lot and go to respond to the fire. I don't know that they do that for the EMTs because the EMTs are on site now, but... And this is to Representative Skudzinski's point. There are some really awesome manufacturers, there's business owners and stuff in our small communities, and you're familiar with them too, Mr. Chair, I know, who just say, go. It's a public service, and they're happy to be a part of it. So I just think that they deserve some recognition for the contribution that they're making to a situation like this. But my question on the bill is in subdivision 2, line 1.20 and 0.21, and then the second page. I'm not clear why that's there, because it's requiring that if they don't qualify, they can apply for the, they can claim the credit, but if something doesn't happen, then they have to file an amended return. And to me, that seems kind of clumsy. Who's going to be responsible for that? And if they don't, then what happens? Who enforces it?
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there was some, what we found out actually when we were researching this, and this was a concern of the auditor also, there are some fire services that don't participate in a service credit, which surprised me because that's part of the 2% pension fund that we put aside for them. And so that's what this kind of goes into to make sure that they can qualify too. So we were a little concerned about that, so we wanted to make sure that everybody that did had some way of getting to this credit. It still will probably need some sort of amendment because we're still looking at that, how that'll work. But thank you for pointing that out.
Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought, and who would be, I mean, would Department of Revenue be monitoring this, or, you know, because how do we make sure it gets straight?
So,
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian. It's a mixture because there are multiple agencies within the state that have to look at the service credits. Some is done by the Department of Public Safety. Others would be done by the MSRB and then would report to the would have to report to the Department of Revenue. We're trying to look at a simplified system also that would be the service director actually filling out that the member made the required service time, and that would be filed with the Department of Revenue. So we're still looking at the process that would take in place, because again, we haven't had this, and it'd be interesting to go back to what we did before to see how they actually enforce that.
Yeah. Very good. Anyone else from the audience that'd like to testify for or against House File 1993? Seeing none. Anyone else from the committee? I remember being at midnight Christmas Mass and the pagers going off at St. Elizabeth and Dilworth and several firefighters leaving. So it is a 24-hour, everyday job. So, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the chief, realizing that, as Representative Carlson noted that volunteerism is kind of a dying service, but what is happening within your service area, particularly for fighting fires, that might be cutting edge research? You know, are you moving toward robotics? I mean, there must be something going on, because the industry must realize that things are changing. So do you know of anything that's cutting edge whereby we won't need as many going to a fire as in the past or present, because we've moved into the robotics area or something other than having an actual person on site?
I am aware of some robotics testing that's gone on over in Europe. I don't know that there's really much of anything like that here in the United States. Typically, you go over to Europe, and that's where a lot of these cutting-edge ideas start. There's different types of firefighting foam. There's different ways of fighting fires. There really isn't a smoking gun or a real cutting edge idea that's just going to start cutting firefighters away. As was mentioned earlier, trying with consolidation, trying to utilize each other's resources and things like that, so we don't need as many. And there's different, besides mergers, there's things called closest unit. So if there's a station or a fire truck, say from Apple Valley, that's near a incident in Lakeville, they are paged out. And so we're using technology that way for closest unit responding. But I wish I had more to offer you on that, but I'm not really aware of much of anything, unfortunately.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt, any closing comments here on House File 1993?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for hearing this. I know that this is a large ask, and that this is just a start to this discussion. And I wanted also to be known that this wasn't brought to me by a volunteer. This wasn't brought to me by a service. This was brought to me as an idea I had last summer when, as an EMT, and we're driving a pond, we see accidents, and we don't pass them, we stop. I stopped at an accident up in northern Minnesota last year, and lo and behold, I had to do some first aid and care for the person until the ambulance arrived. It took 30 minutes for that ambulance to arrive. I knew the chief of the service. I talked to him for a little bit, and he said, thank God you were there, because we had a trouble getting the truck out of the garage. That's what this is about. This isn't about them asking for this. They don't even, when I ask them, they don't care. They'll do this regardless who's there. But it's just something. It's something that we got to start looking at. And, again, thanks, committee, for hearing it. Thanks for the discussion.
Oh, thank you very much, and thanks to the testifiers for being here also. So Representative Rand renews his motion to lay over House File 1993 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Thank you so much, Representative Hewitt. Next, we have House File 2035, and Representative Brand, would you please move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2035, please.
Very good. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the Tax Committee, thank you and good morning for hearing House File 2035. It's a bit of legislation that I think will go a long way to help folks across the state. Section 1 deals with the, of course, adding the tax break preparation for food. And so think of a restaurant, think of somebody that normally sells food, and at the end of the day, they have a large quantity of it. Instead of throwing it away, there's a potential here to help benefit the community in which they sell those goods. And that would address that here in the bill. The effective date is 2019. Section 2 kind of talks a little bit about the differences between the IRS and the state code. Section 3 talks about for every $5 of contribution, a $1 return back from taxes, and so it's 20% to eligible charity for food donations. Subsection 39, Section 1, eligible charitable food donation means a contribution of prepared food allowed as a charitable deduction under Section 170 of the IRS code. Subsection 2 is prepared food means that the quality and labeling standards imposed by federal, state, and local law. And so this is an attempt to make sure that the food that they contribute to the food shelves and that sort of thing are of good quality, because we want to make sure that those contributions are benefiting the folks that will end up using it. The food has to be cooked and heated by the qualifying taxpayer. It must have two or more ingredients mixed together. And any ingredients applied for ingestion or chewing by humans that are consumed must be dedicated towards humans. Of course, you can't mix in things that aren't human food. Then the last thing, I guess, is for a non-resident, there is also eligibility here, or a part-time or part-year resident also is eligible for this. The last part, D, clarification a little bit about the folks that are allowed to benefit from this, and again, 2019 would start, and then I'll turn it over to the first testifier here, and that would be Ben Wolgsland.
Very good. Welcome. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ben Wolgsland. I'm the Director of Government Relations with Hospitality of Minnesota. We represent restaurants, hotels, lodges, and campgrounds in Minnesota. I want to thank the committee for hearing this bill and to Representative Brand for authoring this. Many of you know, I believe there are estimates that 1 in 10 families face food insecurity at some point during the year, and we have, unfortunately, too many people that are facing hunger at different times. This bill is a way that we can help incentivize surplus food to be directed towards soup kitchens and others who are trying to help solve that problem. Restaurants and others that prepare food are in a unique position to try to help in this matter. And there are certain situations where you might have an event. Obviously, this winter is probably a great example of that, where because of inclement weather, you may not have as many people that show up at an event as what you had expected, and you have a lot of food left over. Well, we can incentivize those folks to make sure that that gets donated to helping solve some of our hunger problems, and obviously then the food doesn't go in the waste stream in the same quantity, which is also an added benefit. You know, there's many soup kitchens and feeding sites that utilize locally donated restaurant food to supplement the meals they prepare already. I've been talking with Second Harvest and Catholic Charities and some others. There's some neat things going on in that area. I think they're developing, you know, apps and different things like that are helpful to connect restaurants and others that do these kind of donations with the people that really need it in real time. So I think that's some exciting things that are going on there too. But so that's the nature of the bill. It's as the author indicated, a 20% credit, and to try to incentivize and kind of help this process hopefully grow. And I also have with me here Dave Sintzebau, who is from Crave and Cascade Hospitality.
Very good. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Sintzebau. I am the Chief Operating Officer for Cascade Hospitality and Crave Restaurants. We own and operate 14 restaurants in the metro, along with a catering company. This bill is a good idea. This is a good idea. The restaurants, by nature, we exist to feed people. That's what we do. And we are charitable by nature. I believe in 2015 it was north of $2 million in food donations from restaurants. And We also work in a highly competitive industry, an industry that employs a lot of folks, and an industry that's tough and has a lot of pressures on it and a very low margin. We do it because we love it and because we want to make people happy and feed them. And to have a credit like this when we face those tough situations, which generally when we're in that situation, we're taking a loss. You know, we had an example about a year and a half ago in one of our restaurants where we had a pipe break under the floor and we had to close for 5 days to rip up the floor, redo it. So now we are losing revenue. We have the expense of the repair. And we have all this food sitting in the cooler that's going to go to waste unless we have a way to do something with it. And by being able to donate it and get that credit to help recoup part of that impact to the business and help the community, you know, it's we're going to do the right thing either way. It'd be nice to be recognized for it.
Thank you. Chair Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a couple questions here. First of all, I looked on line 2.18, and it said chewing by humans, and I was concerned with my White Castles, the sliders, that would not qualify. But then if you go before that, it does say ingestion, so that would qualify. They could donate also. But a couple points here. First of all, my first thought, I mean, this bill has had some really fine authors in the past, but I can't remember why I did 20% and not 100%. Why isn't this 100%? Maybe to the author. This should be 100%. This is a big deal. This is really important to get that food that's just going to go to waste, get it to the people that need it. Why? I think when I carried it, it was 20%, and I can't answer why I did that. Why isn't it 100?
Representative Brandt.
Yeah, absolutely. Good consideration. I think in the long and short of it, it's 20% what I thought would be a comfortable number to work with. Of course, it could be higher than that, but I think that in the end of the day, we have to be considerate of where our targets are. We have to be considerate of how much could be benefited from this. Plus, if you look at the potential, I think House research determined that there would be a 5% increase year after year after year in the amount of people participating in this. And so over time, this will cost more money. And so, I don't know, I was thinking when we first talked about this, 20% wouldn't be an okay starter.
Mr. Wagsland.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, I'm not sure if this is the basis for the 20% that you chose or that's in this bill also, but I think a couple of other states that have done this, I believe, are in the 15 to 20% range, so I'm not sure if that was part of the thinking of looking at what's been done in other states or not. Obviously, 100% would be great, but we think this is a good start. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the author said something that I would just caution a little bit about. It's not bill authors' jobs to consider targets. It'll be this committee's and especially the chair's to consider targets. So that shouldn't be a consideration. I don't know why I was at 20%. I mean, we should have been much higher. But the other question is, and I don't recall if it's in my bill, are there Good Samaritan provisions here so that if some food went from a restaurant someplace and there happened to be a problem, that there would be some leniency on the person? That I know you got liability insurance, things like that, but in some of the bills that I've seen that have to do with food shelves, giving to food shelves, whatever, have a Good Samaritan provision. I don't see that in this bill. Or did I miss it?
Representative Brand?
I think if you look at line 2.20, number 3, qualifying taxpayer means an individual or entity that makes a charitable food donation. And so I believe in that interpretation that would mean also a church or people who are giving contributions to the food shelf. But I might be wrong.
Well, I think Chair Davids is looking for, in case something was wrong with the food that was donated and someone got sick from it, if there'd be some sort of liability immunity or something like that. Mr. Wagsland?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, my understanding is that there's protection from liability under the federal law. I think it's an existing federal law that provides protection from that kind of liability, but that's a great question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just does this apply to an individual? So let's say I'm out on the town and decide to, you know, donate part of my meal that I didn't finish. I mean, people do that. I mean, they do. You know, well, people. I mean, if you go to New York, they do that often. But I mean, would that qualify?
Representative Brand. Mr. Waxland?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swisinski, no, it does not allow for that. My understanding is that current health regulations in Minnesota would not allow for even the donation of food that had been placed out in a buffet. If it's been served, you can't repurpose it for a charitable contribution.
And then
Representative Swisinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of just from a valuation standpoint, would this be considered a retail value? So, you know, obviously from a cost standpoint, if you're a restaurant, you say, right, my inputs to this meal are X, or is it what you would have sold that meal as a retail cost?
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Swisinski, yes, a retail cost.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I probably spent about a decade or so working for the Buffalo Food Shelf. Started it as a volunteer because I thought it was a good thing for my kids to learn volunteerism. And let's just say my work was noticed, and then they asked me to be on the board, and next thing I know, I'm staff. So I've done everything at the Buffalo Food Shelf, treasury work and day-to-day routine stuff. So we kind of went through an evolution in that decade that I was there where the Walmarts and the Targets and the Cub Foods and the Coburns began to donate their fruits and vegetables and things like that and breads that were about to expire. And so what we did, though, because this is how you do this in a food shelf, and I don't know if this has been talked about, but you weigh it. Everything is by weight. And it's not by the value of the donation. And so we would acknowledge the weight that came in. Mm-hmm. So I see here, like, the question was asked by Representative Swisinski about the value. And I'm not sure that that lines up exactly with what, if it's going to a food shelf anyway, with what food shelves do, just as a consideration. I'm not sure exactly how you line all that up. And then I would ask about, more specifically, about the documentation. So can you just go through your thought process as to how you're going to document this for Department of Revenue so that you can receive the 20% tax credit? And then I have another quick question. In fact, I'll just ask the question now so that you can just answer both. Sure. On line 2.16, you talked about it has to be cooked or heated, and I just told you that the food shelf readily accepted donations of fruits and vegetables and breads and things like that. 39 cents. But you've sort of excluded things like salads or cold vegetables by that, and can you give us the reason for that? Because that is something that food shelves readily give out, and just wondering the thought process behind that.
Representative Brand.
Certainly. First of all, thank you for your contribution of your time to the food shelf in Buffalo. I grew up in Howard Lake, and so I appreciate the fact that you're helping out people in my nearby community, so I appreciate that. To answer your questions, I guess I would defer over to the person with the big binder of information. You might have some of that in there. It's not maybe cost research.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, my understanding is in both the way that the federal program works and the way that this will work is that it's based upon the retail value or what the market value of whatever the donated item would be. I believe in terms of kind of documenting that, which is a good question, my understanding is that there's a receipt that's given by whether it's, you know, Second Harvest or whoever the entity is that the restaurant or other entity we give it to needs to receive a receipt and document that for tax purposes for when they file and request the credit. As to the question you know, uncooked food versus cooked food, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that in terms of could we expand it beyond just cooked food. I think, potentially probably depends on what that food is. I think bread probably meets the definition of being cooked at one point, but clearly, as you mentioned, fruits probably don't. That's something that we could look at in terms of expanding, and I'm not sure where the health department would fall on that, but I'm guessing they probably may not have a problem if it's already happening, so that might be a good way we could expand it.
Mr. Sensabaugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, I think the intent of the bill is that product that has been prepared for service and then is not able to be used, as opposed to raw ingredients like fruits and vegetables, are easier to repurpose in those situations, but if, you know, we've cooked off the wings or we've cooked off, you know, the meatloaf or whatever it is, that's not as easy to repurpose. And so I think that's the intent of the bill. Certainly, yes, if we've prepared a salad in bulk for an event and then it doesn't get used, that would be an item we would love to be able to get the credit on when we donate as well.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I still have a concern about the documentation. I just know that if you're going to give this to a food shelf, they are not going to have that kind of documentation. They'd have to create something. And I can tell you that after being at the food shelf I was at for, and by the way, we did serve Howard Lake. So if someone from Howard Lake came to Buffalo, we took care of them. But we literally served all of Wright County. We really grew. And they've grown since I've left. But this would be something, at least for food shelf, in my experience, that they would have to create something new as far as documentation to show the retail value of that, because we just do pounds. So we just weigh everything in and weigh everything out, and it's something that is spoiled. It also has to be weighed, and we have to reconcile all that weight, which sounds like a weird thing, but that's what we do. So we weigh everything in. We weigh everything going out to the customer, and we weigh all the spoiled food, and it all has to reconcile. I know that because I've done that for years. I've had to reconcile those numbers. And I've weighed a lot of food. So anyway, just a thought, and maybe if you're sending it to Second Harvest, that's a huge warehouse, so I'm not quite sure how they would do it. You know, I mean, that's like, you know, the cereals and, you know, all of these, you know, boxed and prepared foods go to Second Harvest. But I'm just trying to understand, like, where the food would go. Maybe, like, Helping Hands or Sharing Caring Hands or something. But out in the rural area, they basically have food shelves. Mm-hmm. So just something to think about, because I think maybe a little more conversation with people out in Wright County, places like that that actually run food shelves, could maybe give you a little more help with that part of it and make sure that it actually works for them. Mm-hmm. So just some thoughts. And I'd love to see this actually expanded to more than just cook, because the cold things are things that people really are looking for, too, at the food shelves, particularly fruits, the vegetables, all that kind of stuff.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think I have some answers for several of the questions here. So on line 2.15, it's includes food that is cooked or heated. It's not exclusive. So it's not, you know, only limited to its you know, just saying that it includes those things. So my interpretation is that would include things that aren't cooked or heated. As far as, you know, can I give my leftovers to somebody on line 2.21, engaged in a trade or business that includes regularly selling prepared food. So I don't think that would apply to, you know, any of us, unless that's part of our business that we're already taking part in. On the immunity and there is a federal Good Samaritan law I'm familiar with. We donate food through our church, through a backpack program to local families. And I researched this because I was the only attorney of the volunteers there. So there's actually a really nice handout from Mitchell Hamlin Public Law Center that I will send to staff to email out to folks that explains that Good Samaritan law. And finally, I wanted to point out that the other people that this would apply to, the other types of businesses, would be our convenience stores. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of those convenience stores in our communities, and I know because my family has owned one in rural Minnesota for a couple decades, and, you know, they operate really close to the margins. And, you know, in a lot of our communities, there aren't that many. Crave doesn't exist in Cass Lake, Minnesota. But there are a couple convenience stores that offer, you know, different types of food. And I know that a lot of those businesses, you know, at the end of the night, it actually was my first job was making pizzas at a Hot Stuff Pizza. And I remember there were folks that would hang out outside when we would close because they were hungry and they knew that, you know, anything that was left over, the manager was going to let them have. So I think just kind of wanted to point out that it isn't just, you know, our fancy restaurants
But also, you know, there are some smaller businesses in all over our state that could take advantage of this. So thank you for bringing it forward, Representative Brand.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My primary question, I think, was already answered in regard to the potential for liability exposure, because I know as a church we used to give out free meals, and we're always concerned about people taking meals home if they didn't keep them prepared and warm, et cetera, and then get sick later. But I think that was answered. But I wanted to follow up a little bit with Representative O'Neill's question and verification. If I read the law, or the bill, excuse me, the way it's set, I don't believe there's any reporting or verification required of the receiving agency. This is all going to be self-reported. Is that correct?
Who wants to answer that? Representative Brand?
Yeah, that is my understanding as well. Similar to if you were to contribute some clothing to the Epilepsy Foundation, you support that as well. Or if you were to do your mileage and your taxes, there are a lot of different things within our tax code where we self-report. Obviously, if there was a situation where they were being audited, they would have to show proof of that. And so I think the onus is on the person that's reporting to show proof of it with receipts. Obviously, some sort of a reporting by Second Harvest Heartland or another organization would also be a valuable resource to have in that situation.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. That's kind of how I read it, too. And the other question just gets into the value. This the value that is being taken, and 20% of it is actually on the retail price and not on the inputs. Is that correct?
Representative Brand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think we ought to save food whenever we can and put it to good use. However, just as these businesses, even though they're in the food business and will be serving customers the next day, can't always use what they've got left over, neither can the charities. And I have heard from some that it's really difficult for them to have somebody pull up with a truck just before they're closing and say, here, thank you, you know, and they may not have refrigeration space for it or an ability to use it. And it's in some situations, I know of at least one food shelf, where their compost costs have gone up dramatically because they're not able to use within the time frame that would be appropriate, the food that's dropped. And our large shelters for people who are homeless, they know they're full up every day, so they have to figure out, how am I going to feed these 100 people or these, you know, 20 families or whatever. And so I think the incentive is good, but I think I would put a closed loop on this and have the actual recipient estimate the percent of product that was able to be used. Just as when you give, you know, to another charity, they give you a receipt and that sort of thing. I think it should, especially if it's going to be based on retail price, it should actually be about the amount that was actual able to be used. And that creates an incentive for the business and the recipient to work together on figuring out a process of interacting, giving them as much early notice as possible, that sort of thing, so that it actually works on both sides of the equation. So I would, you know, I'm not discouraging this moving forward so much as just saying I think it needs to work on both sides. And we didn't have any testifiers from the recipients, potential recipients of this, and I think we need to hear a little bit more about, from their perspective, how to make this work.
Representative O'Neill, you've got a follow-up.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just a couple now. So I want to point out to the committee that on line 2.17, in that series that Representative Becker Finn pointed out, there's an and, which means all three conditions must be considered. So it's not an or, it's an and. And so my reading of the bill that way would be it has to be cooked or heated and two or more ingredients and so and ingested by humans. Yes. So by wording it that way, anything cold, salads, whatever, would be excluded, which is why I had the question. Also, to Representative Loeffler, interesting idea, but I just got to tell you, from someone who has done all that paperwork and created all that paperwork where there was none, that would be incredibly onerous if we got a donation of something in and then try to document how much of that actually got distributed, because we're getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds of food coming from all over the place at any given day, to document what came specifically from this program would just be incredibly onerous. I don't think it would even be able to be accomplished. Just as a thought, these are all volunteers, and because I had an accounting background, I was launched into the middle of this poor little fledgling little food shelf at the time, and they hadn't reported their 990s for 3 years, and I saved them from closure, and that's why I ended up as a treasurer on the board. So you're talking about people that may or may not have the capacity to, I'll tell you right now, they don't have the capacity to do that. So I would ask the bill author not to ask for additional documentation from the food shelf as to what was distributed, because that would be, they wouldn't take it. I could just tell you that right now. They don't have the capacity. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have Chair Davids and then Representative Carlson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of points. First of all, I think Representative O'Neill hit well on that it is prepared food. It's not just bringing in anything. It has to be prepared food in this bill. But I would respectfully disagree with Representative Loeffler and Representative O'Neill on the willingness or ability of food shelves to take stuff. Because when I back up the truck, we just unload, they weigh it, and they're very, very thankful. I've never seen a food shelf, and I've seen many, I've never seen a food shelf say, oh, please don't bring us that stuff. They figure out a way to document they know what they're doing. But I, like I said, they've always been thankful, very kind, and I don't think it's onerous to them at all. Well, some of it's kind of heavy, but I usually lift that. So it's, I don't think there's a problem on the other side. If there was a problem on the other side, they'd be here. And they're not here. They're very thankful for what donations are made, and I think this is a good bill, and we should go forward.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at 2.12. Prepared food means food that meets all quality and labeling standards imposed by state and federal and local. I'm having trouble envisioning just how that would work. What came to my mind when the question of liability came up was food allergies. You know, for example, some restaurants would use peanut oil, and there are a lot of people that have strong reactions. In fact, it can even be death-threatening under certain circumstances when they react. So I'm just trying to envision a restaurant donating food and how that would be properly labeled so that people that might have a food allergy would be aware of the contents of the food.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, so I've had, you know, a couple of conversations with Second Harvest and Catholic Charities, who is supportive of this concept. A couple of things on the actual process. So my understanding is a lot of the recipients treat donated food from restaurants or this kind of prepared food as if it has allergens, all those allergens you just mentioned in it, just to be on the safe side from their side of things. So I think that's a good question. I think clearly there are certain things that would be added into food that wouldn't be readily apparent to one of the recipient organizations right off the bat. And so my understanding is that's how they treat it for those purposes as they repurpose it.
Representative Carlson.
And Mr. Chairman, maybe if you could expand then, because it does say properly labeled. So when the restaurant would bring the food in, would it be labeled somehow what those ingredients were, so that people would be aware? And I don't mean to pick on the peanut oil industry alone, but there would be other allergies that could be triggered. Some people have allergies with eggs, and you know, you can go right on down the list. And I'm just wondering how that labeling part of it would
who wants to answer that?
Mr. Sensenbaugh. Representative Carlson, thank you for the question. My understanding of that section is that it's relating to health code labeling, name of the product, not a list of ingredients, when it was prepared, what the shelf life is for that item, and when it expires. So we normally label, you know, whether it's tomato sauce, the date it was prepared, and then the shelf life or the date that it expires. I understand that to to refer to that labeling as opposed to a full list of ingredients. Even in our restaurants, we offer a gluten-sensitive menu. We do not offer a gluten-free menu because there is flour in our kitchen, and we can't guarantee anything is 100% gluten-free. So to try and take that level when we're already, as Representative O'Neill referenced, the paperwork on the back end, I think, as Ben noted, the charities assume everything is, quote-unquote, contaminated with all allergies.
Thank you. Chair Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just very briefly, I made some comments on Representative O'Neill's comments, and I misunderstood them. Maybe she could clarify.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was only talking about Representative Loeffler's idea to document this specific donation, tracking it all the way through the system. Yeah. And I can tell you from doing all of that documentation and pages and pages and pages of Excel spreadsheets, that would be really onerous, that part of it. They track all the donations coming in as a whole, all the donations going out as a whole, and all the spoilage. But if you're going to track specific donations from a specific place, that gets really, really complicated and very onerous. And that was my only concern about that.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. David?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the benefits of sitting right here is that I'm right next to House Research, and I was wondering if they could speak to the concern about whether salads would be included and the language on line 2.15.
Mr. Clayman, are salads included?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Just to clarify the definition of prepared food in the bill on line 2.12, prepared food just means food, and it's food that meets all quality and labeling standards imposed. And then what follows on lines 2.16 to 2.19 is just a non-exclusive list of foods that would qualify that are maybe more appropriate for the industries that would be donating the prepared food. So as I read the definition, I think it would include a salad that was prepared. So.
There we go. We solved that. Maybe. Is there anyone else from the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 2035? Seeing none. Representative Brand, any final comments?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this bill today. I think it does two things. I think it definitely benefits people in our communities across the state that otherwise are food insecure. And then it also eliminates or at least reduces the amount of food that's going into the garbage or compost when that could be utilized in food preparation. So just a little bit of perspective in my district, District 19A, it's mostly Nicollet County, a little sliver of Mankato and Blue Earth County, and then a little bit of Cassota, Township Cassota in LeSueur County. So I have three counties. But these numbers are just for Nicollet County. There were 4,900 people that were food insecure last year. That represents over 1.05 million missed meals. And so these points of data come from the Second Harvest Heartland research that was done. And so that hits home, obviously, because that's my home turf. And so I know that this bill will benefit the Echo Food Shelf in Mankato, and it'll also benefit the St. Pierre Food Shelf, which is two food shelves that will help folks in my district get the food that they need. So
thank you
for hearing the bill, and I appreciate your support. And
Representative Brand renews his motion to lay over House File 2035 for possible inclusion into the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, testifiers. Thank you. And I'm going to turn this over to Representative Lethbridge.
Okay, the next bill we have before us is House File 1763. Representative Marcor, would you like to move the bill before the committee?
I would like to move House File 1763 for possible inclusion in the tax omnibus bill. And Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment, the A1 amendment to, and I will move the A1 amendment. And the A1 amendment is basically to get things into its proper form.
Okay, does everyone have the amendment? Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Marquardt, your bill.
So, well, thank you so much. I'm very, a little disappointed we don't have a packed house to hear the Minnesota taxpayer receipt bill, but here it is. So, members, we've talked about this in here that every taxpayer should know where their tax dollars go and what type of a value they're getting for their tax dollars. And so what this bill would do is require the Minnesota Management and Budget Department to set up a website where a taxpayer could go in and calculate where their tax dollars are going. And in your packets, there is one example I put in here that, and it's just an idea, but this is for the U.S. federal budget, but it, you know, what a taxpayer would be able to do is put in the amount that they paid into their income taxes. The website would be able to estimate based on your income how much you would probably have paid in sales tax, but there could be a portion in there also that if you purchase something for over $1,000 or something, let's say you purchased a boat or something, you could put that amount in, and of course that would raise the average up that you may spend on sales taxes. Also, it could calculate, if you wanted to check a box, whether or not you've consumed alcohol or you smoke and that type of thing, to try to get an idea, and also the gas tax, how much you would pay into that. And then it would, once you have put those numbers in, it would calculate where those dollars go. You know, how much went into E-12 education, how much went into health and human services, and it could break that down into categories. So you could actually see, you know, $982 is going towards this, and you'd be able to get that information. So it improves transparency. I think it would improve some accountability. And then the second side of this is that you could also, off of this website, go and see what type of value you're getting for your dollars. And if you go right now to the MMB website, there's a couple portions on that website where they have data. The one's called the Minnesota Dashboard, and there they have like 8 different areas, the economy, education, environment, health, safety, mobility, and then it's got indicators, and it'll give you a stat and give you like the status, and then is it improving or not improving, that type of thing. So that's kind of one area you could look at. There's also something called Results First that kind of, they work with the Pew Charitable Trust and the MacArthur Foundation, and they look at kind of evidence-based ideas that have actually worked, and you can click on there. And so a lot of the information's there because MMB has to present that when they present their budget. And it's under statute. So you'll see we mentioned statute 16A.10, subdivision 1B, and that's the MMB budget preparation, where they already have to do a lot of these things. I think the main point on this is to make it more maybe taxpayer-friendly. So if you're able to go on, you'd maybe be able to measure and look, see what happened in years past. Are you moving up or are you moving down or whatever way you go? And then ultimately, you could print this receipt out. It also would require information to go out stating where, like when you file your taxes, where you could get this information or where's the website. And also, if you want to get it by mail, the information, you could do that. So, members, this, you know, I'm open to any and all ideas, but the idea is to get something where you could actually see where your tax dollars are going and actually see in a taxpayer-friendly way what those tax dollars are doing and if what type of value you're getting for those and so forth. So, you know, we've got a couple, 3 weeks before the tax bill reaches kind of its final form, so if folks have ideas, I'm open, but I think you understand kind of the concept of what we're trying to do with this. So, members, I'm open for questions, and I don't have a line of witnesses in support or opposed, I guess, that I know of right yet. So at any point, I'll take questions.
Any questions? Representative Peter.
Was that me? Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the only question I have is just – you know, we always kind of worry about Big Brother looking over our shoulder. Is there any protections that this data, because it will now automatically be categorized, that it can be used for something other than what the taxpayer wants it to be used for?
You know, Representative Petersburg, that is a great point. I don't have that in here, I don't believe, but it certainly, if this makes the final cut, something like that would have to be in there.
Right.
I just hadn't thought about that. Of course, this is voluntary, of course, to go on, but that's excellent point. Excellent point.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Marquardt, does MMB have software in place now so that this would be an easy addition for them to add to their dashboard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I don't know if they have the software available to take this. I don't believe they do, that I know of. I know there's a cost of, I think, $127,000 the first year, and then for a full-time position, I think, to get this up and going, and then a half-time after that, I believe. But I don't think they have this capability right now to do that. I know they've got kind of this dashboard and results first on there for performance, but not the calculator that I'm aware of.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Marquardt, does MMB like this idea?
Chair Marquardt.
Chair and Representative Erickson, I don't know.
Okay. Anything further, Representative Erickson?
No, thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Okay, sure.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Marquardt. I noticed that one of the more popular bills this year, I think they actually had to do a clone, was Representative Erdahl's strengthening civics education in the schools, and I think this is another contribution to that, because I think there's still a lot of people who don't really understand the breadth and depth of what state government does in their life, and it's another way to give some information out. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Anyone from the audience wish to testify for or against? Hearing none. Final last words?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think taxpayers deserve to know where their tax dollars are going and what type of value they're getting for that. I mean, I think taxpayers should know that every dollar they give is making our communities safer, stronger, healthier, better educated, all those things. There should be an expectation for the taxpayer to do that. And I think as a state, we need to come up with a way in which they can get that information. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
With that, Chair Marquardt renews his motion for House File 1763 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and the bill will be laid over as amended. Anything else to come before the body? Hearing none, we are adjourned.